Good morning. First argument on the calendar this morning is Perkanian for State of Nevada, 66763. This is scheduled for 1 hour. If counsel for Mr. Perkanian is ready to proceed, please do so. If you wish to reserve time, so state.
May it please this honorable court, I am Tom Erickson. I am representing the appellant, Vitas Archanian. This is a case that I believe presents numerous important constitutional issues as to the representation that Mr. Archanian received at the trial level. In going back through the nearly 10 years that I have personally been on this case and the extensive briefing that has been presented to the court, I am somewhat at a loss of where to begin or where to focus, but I will begin with this number, and that is the number 11. 11 is the number of hours that there is any documentation of investigation on this capital murder case. We presented in our opening brief the one document of investigation receipts, and that's Exhibit 864. It shows 11 hours were paid for an investigator in this case. And of that 11 hours, it appears not 1 minute was spent on mitigation investigation. It appears that the vast majority of the time was spent on doing a background investigation on the victim's two children, and then some investigation related to the video that's been referenced in the briefing. The other significance of 11 is that's the total number of visits that Mr. Archanian received from his trial counsel prior to going to trial. And particularly, there were 4 visits by the California attorney who was the lead attorney on the case, who was hired by Mr. Archanian's family. As you're aware from the briefing, this family, they mortgaged their homes. They came up with somewhere between $175,000 and $200,000 that was paid to the California attorney to defend Mr. Archanian. There is not one piece of evidence indicating that there were any experts consulted or hired by the defense counsel. There is not one shred of evidence that there was any mental health experts that were hired in preparation for this capital.
Well, let me just tell you what we're used to, Ms. Erickson. When we have these cases, especially when we have the federal public defender doing this ineffective assistance of counsel when it comes to mitigation, they come in with all the mitigation. What type of mitigation would have been found on this particular case? Why don't you go over that? I think that's the most important part. And show us how prejudiced this defendant as far as this homicide case and this death penalty.
Yes, Your Honor, I would be happy to do that. We have presented numerous affidavits from family members. Mr. Archanian was 20 years old when he was brought to the United States from the country of Armenia. We have gone through with affidavits from, to begin with, the mental health expert, Dr. Chatfield. His 25-page report is included as an exhibit, which outlines extensive mental disorders that he determined from numerous interviews that he had with family members, extensive interviews that he had with Mr. Archanian, as well as reviews of the various chemicals that Mr. Archanian was exposed to, both in his occupation as a jeweler and, I think, more importantly, as a youth in Armenia. We have presented extensive documentation of the chemical exposure that many Armenians in the capital city of Armenia, of Yerevan, which is where Mr. Armenian was raised, in the water system, the incredibly high level of toxicity in the system, and the high level of neurological issues that Armenians have been exposed to over the years, that I think is documented very thoroughly in the briefing, coupled with numerous family members who provided affidavits related to the strange behavior that that Mr. Archanian exhibited from the time he was a young boy, the multiple times of head trauma that he experienced as a child. All of these things put together with the upbringing that he experienced. We've gone through at length talking about the social upbringing, being in a Russian-Soviet country, the effects that the Armenians have experienced from the generations of trauma from the Turkish fighting that they experienced, and how that affected grandparents and their raising of children. All of that is documented in detail in the briefing that we've presented. From my perspective, this would be a mitigation case that would likely take a week to 10 days of presenting experts related to the chemical exposure that Mr. Arkanian had, the mental health issues that were found by Dr. Schatfeld, the extensive family history that was presented by numerous aunts and uncles and siblings and children of Mr. Archanian that is included in the affidavits that were provided for the court's consideration. This case, where the documentation from the affidavits indicate that the family members, they provided over 30 family members for the defense attorneys to interview and obtain information from. They, in their affidavits, indicated that the night before a few of them were called to testify, was the first time they were asked any questions about Mr. Armenian's background. And they basically, as documented in the record, just got up and said that Mr. Cheney was a nice man and that he wouldn't have done something like this. There is substantial historical information, substantial mental health information that should have been presented to a jury had the proper experts been retained, had the proper interviewing of family members and experts been presented to the jury. Another important deficiency from our perspective goes to the guilt-innocence phase of the trial, and that is the lack of a motion to suppress evidence that the trial attorneys failed to file related to items obtained beyond the authorization of the search warrants. The search warrants were very specific, and the information that the police officers were allowed to obtain, critical DNA-related material, was obtained beyond the scope of the search warrants, as outlined in the briefing. And that evidence is some of the strongest evidence that was presented to the trial jury that should have, from our perspective, been excluded had the attorneys simply compared the search warrants with what was obtained and how the prosecution presented it at trial.
As far as the guilt phase, I'm sure that the district attorney would argue that it's harmless, that even if there was a mistake, it was harmless. How do you answer that? Harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? under the facts of this case.
Yeah. And, Your Honor, a couple of responses to that. First is that the defense attorneys failed to follow up on an alternative suspect that was referenced by the police from the outset. There was another individual who had been convicted previously of a homicide and robberies who was a potential suspect in this case, and there was no presentation to the jury related or investigation related to that alternative suspect. As to the facts of the case, basically, Mr. Archanian is the one who called the police and reported that he found the victims at the jewelry store where he was working. The police indicate that he was cooperative, that he was helpful, he waited around for them to arrive. The video, that there's quite a bit of argument related to that in the briefing, but the video, as described by the police officer who obtained it, indicated that it was a dark video, and that from the video, he could not make out who the suspect was. Had the DNA evidence been excluded, which we believe should have been, had the motion to suppress been filed, what the evidence would have shown is they had a dark video that was difficult to make out who the suspect was, a very cooperative Mr. Archanian, who was the one who called the police, and that there were alternative suspects that the police were initially looking into. Had all of that information been presented to a jury, I believe that the outcome would likely have been very different than what ultimately happened at the trial.
Excuse me, sir, but yes. If they hadn't investigated these other suspects, what information would they have gotten to present? What, the fact that there were other people in the world, if an investigation had been done, and this is the problem I'm having with the mitigation thing too, is kind of that closing the deal. If this had been done, what concrete facts or evidence would have been presented?
Your Honor, I think that the critical facts would have been there was another suspect with convictions of the same type of crime we have here. Another homicide, other robberies related to jewelry stores. And that is obviously the facts of this case. A jewelry store robbery that resulted in death. So the fact that the police were looking into that as a defense attorney, I certainly think that on cross-examination, you would bring that up, go into that information that the police were alerted to this individual, and they would respond however they would. But for a jury to know that there were other suspects with that type of background, I think would be incredibly important in the defense issue as to the guilt or innocence.
Mr. Erickson, does this record include evidence of Magnesian's prior criminal history? I know that, is it Zabal Ghanian had claimed that this individual was involved somehow and asserted that there had been some prior criminal history. But is that in this record, or is that simply asserted by virtue of the Ghanian claims or accusations?
Your Honor, from my understanding, that is through the witness who had called in and reported that individual.
Okay, so aside from Ghanian's claims, about which there seemed to be some problem, is there any other information in this record about other suspects other than Magnesian?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. And then another thing that I wanted to ask you about, I noticed throughout various claims of error, there seems to be a recurring theme from the family members that your client had a phobia against about blood,
as well as an inability to function in emergency situations. That phobia and behavior seems to be contrary to the acts with which he was accused. Yet I don't see that really developed here much. Do you have any comment about that?
Your Honor, I guess the response I would have is, based on the psychological report that Dr. Schatfeld prepared, where he addresses that issue that was reported by a number of people and the issues that he had in interviewing Mr. Archanian and the anxiety episode Mr. Archanian had even during the interview up at the Ely State Prison, and Mr. Schatfeld interviewed him on a two-day period. Obviously, this is a case where there are issues related to the guilt phase and and likely more strongly the issues related to...
So on that point, there seems to be some fairly substantial jurisprudence that would counter your argument about the exclusion of the DNA evidence by reason of the problems associated with the affidavit, or the search warrant, excuse me, and the description of the search warrant. If one assumes that the DNA evidence was properly admitted, would your arguments focus more on the penalty phase than on the guilt phase? Or do you believe that had the DNA evidence been admitted, coupled with the other evidence in the case, that the jury would have arrived at a different result based on the errors you've been focusing on?
Your Honor, I would acknowledge that if the DNA evidence was properly admitted, that it would be a difficult defense case as far as what was presented.
So what do you think this court should do with the jurisprudence you folks discussed in your arguments about the discovery or observation of evidence, pants with blood on and so forth, that wasn't specifically delineated in the search warrant? Seems like our cases and other cases would approve of that, to the recovery of that material, don't you think?
Your Honor,
what should we do with that?
Your Honor, the U.S. Supreme Court cases that we cited to there, over the last week I've been going back through, and this was submitted a couple of years ago, just verifying the current state of the cases, and from what I read, that there's still a good case law that where investigators go beyond the scope of a delineated search warrant, for example, the finding the clothing back behind the little dresser, and I believe that clearly is because that there was no indication other than the search warrant said that they could get trace evidence from items found in the car, but did not indicate as to the house, and did not indicate that they could take clothing from him.
But the search warrant allowed them to be in the house.
Correct.
Yeah.
Mr. Erickson, how do you distinguish or address Lester versus State then? It gives you the case basically gives you an opportunity, gives the officers an opportunity to seize evidence that indicate there was a crime committed. Do you know Lester versus State? Are you familiar with that?
Yes, Your Honor. I know it certainly in general. I don't know all the specifics to it, but from my perspective with the U.S. Supreme Court case law, I think that the search here went, because they articulate a number of things that they're looking for. These items were not articulated there, and if they could have contacted the judge who authorized this search and requested additional authorization to take this, because what they were getting was trace evidence that they had specifically requested for the vehicle, but they did not for the house. And that, I think, is the important distinction. It isn't as though they weren't aware of requesting this type of information or this type of evidence. They simply failed to do so as to the search of the house. And I think that the clothing that was found and the testing that they did on that clothing should have been suppressed.
And again, under Lusk, it wouldn't require them to go back to the judge and get an additional or extended search warrant.
And to the extent that that is in contradiction to the U.S. cases, and I can quickly pull those up. And to get back to the question, Aaron, that you'd asked as far as what we would argue, if the DNA is admissible, I think that the focus of this case is a retrial of the penalty phase.
So with respect to that point, do you think this court made an error when it reweighed without the consideration of all of this additional mitigation evidence? The reweighing considerations here has been a troubling factor for me, and I wondered if you could comment on that question as to whether or not this court should revisit the penalty phase in its previous rehearing decision, or reweighing decision, excuse me.
Your Honor, I certainly, to the extent that if this court were to reweigh with all of the, and the record that's been presented is, I think, close to 2,800 pages of affidavits and scientific studies from Armenia related to many, many mental health and physical health issues from the high percentages of Armenians. If that is reconsidered to the benefit of Mr. Archinian, I certainly think that you have the authority to do that. But from my perspective at this stage, what should happen is the case should be remanded at a minimum for a new mitigation trial. We just did one on a 30-year-old case a month and a half, I guess 2 months ago. What should have been presented in 2004 when this case went to trial from our perspective is certainly different than what was being presented in 1986 when this case we just retried was presented. But the critical role that a defense attorney has to help a jury understand who their client is and all of the environmental, the family, the social impact on that person, for a jury to make a true distinguishing determination as to whether or not this person is, as is often said, the worst of the worst and deserves the death penalty, is critical. And from the record that we've been provided, that was not done in this case. The lack of any significant investigation into the social history of this man, the mental health history of this man, is, in my opinion, just shocking. And what could have and should have been presented, I believe, very likely would have made a difference in...
Did the penalty phase jury identify mitigators, and what mitigators were they? Could you refresh my memory about that?
And, Your Honor, I apologize.
That question is no prior criminal history.
Yeah, and I apologize. That does sound right, but it was very limited. It was one day of presenting some family members who said that this wasn't in his nature, and that was basically it.
Mr. Erickson, you have 6 minutes left for rebuttal, roughly, at this point.
Thank you. I will conclude at this point. Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Steve Owens of the Clark County District Attorney's district attorney's office on behalf of the state of Nevada, the respondent in this case. I don't believe the record in this case shows that there was only 11 hours of investigation that was done. It shows that there was an investigator who spent 11 hours on the guilt phase of the case for Macy-Ampolsky. We did not hear any testimony from William Grayson, the retained attorney who was primarily in charge of the mitigation and the penalty phase of the case. So we don't know that there was only 11 hours done. We also don't... He is deceased. We also don't know that there was, well, we know that there was no evidence of any experts that were presented. We don't know that no experts were consulted. Macy-Ampolsky testified. He could not recall whether or not they had consulted and hired and enlisted the help of experts and simply decided not to use them. So I don't think we can take from the testimony and evidence that was adduced in this case to the conclusion that no work was done. It's a big unknown. We simply don't know. Macy-Ampolsky's memory was very, very spotty. He did not recall much. The evidence, in fact, I asked no questions of him in the evidentiary hearing because I had not perceived that he had done any damage whatsoever to my case. He had not done anything to support the defense's case to confirm or deny any of their allegations. The evidence that they bring forward now of the defendant's extensive mental disorders consists of a blood phobia. Well, that was known and testified to at trial by family members, and that was not found to be a mitigating circumstance. Compulsive skin picking disease, I don't even understand how that is even remotely mitigating. I mean, what are they going to say, that he murdered these two women because he has compulsive skin picking disease? Their expert got that from talking to family members. That could have been elicited from family members if it was in any way, shape, or form mitigating. I don't see how it possibly is. The other mental disorders are that he's moody and anxious. One of the diagnoses was not otherwise specified, a personality disorder not otherwise specified, and they define that as meaning that he doesn't qualify, doesn't meet all the characteristics of any disorder, and he must have something, so they call it this NOS, not otherwise specified. In terms of psychological reports, this one's very, very tame. There's just not a whole lot in there of a mitigating nature. In fact, I argued and the judge below found, and there were written findings done by the judge, not by me in this case. The judge drafted her own findings and entitled to deference. She found that that this new mitigation evidence was not in fact mitigating, and that it in fact could have been very harmful. The mitigation case that was put forward by William Grayson, he may be deceased, but we can look at the record and see that he had a strategy. We can see that he was pursuing a theory. He presented evidence from seven family members, or friends of family members in mitigation. They put on four family members in defense. And in mitigation in particular, they elicited testimony that he was a kind and loving man, that he was very kind to others, that he had done good deeds as a child and as an adult, that he had fled communist oppression from Armenia, and that he'd come here with his family. Incidentally, he'd spent more years here in America than he ever did in Armenia. And nothing that Tom Erickson's investigator was able to find over in Armenia could really enlarge the picture. There was a huge Armenian community right here. So many of the friends and family who knew him best were already here. His wife, his son, friends that had also immigrated who knew him as a child. So it's not like there was some missing piece in Armenia that that was not had. They talked to the family members. And they portrayed him with all these good attributes, as you would think you would want to do to save someone's life, to show that he has some redeeming qualities. They testified that Archanian's father died a couple years after immigrating here, and Archanian took the role as the family leader, and that the family looked to him for help, and that he helped other families immigrate here to the United States. Unfortunately, the jury didn't find any of that to be mitigating. They did find lack of criminal history to be the only mitigating circumstance, although they offered about eight different mitigators, all pertaining to his good qualities and the good deeds that he had done throughout his life.
Mr. Owens, could I interrupt you?
Yes.
As you were making a
point about the judge's findings regarding whether the evidence, this additional evidence of mitigator, whether it is or not, is a separate question, that the judge's observation is that it could have impacted adversely Archanian's defense. But with defense counsel who testified not able to remember and the other defense counsel deceased, there certainly is no evidence of any strategic decision to not present this mitigating evidence, correct? And well, that conclusion, no deference would be, should be extended, should it?
I think any time there's an evidentiary hearing, this court must defer. And the district court judge is given the first opportunity to make some of these decisions, whether or not there is an evidentiary hearing. They have to make certain findings of fact, even if just based on the record that they have before them, the trial record, and draw some conclusions. And then this court reviews for abuse of discretion. And so, yeah, I think those findings are entitled to deference. And she made these determinations that this stuff would not have been helpful in her estimate. And I don't think you get to review that decision de novo. I think
so the basis of her finding is not that it was a strategic decision, but just in the judge's assessment, it wouldn't have made a difference on the guilt phase, in the penalty phase. Well, either phase, I suppose.
Yes, I believe that's how it should be characterized. The defense failed to bring forth sufficient evidence to show that had they offered this new mitigation, that it would have made a difference in the case. Mm-hmm. A lot of these questions are not purely factual, purely legal. A lot of them are mixed. And where the line is, it's hard to distinguish. But she considered the testimony. She considered the record. She made extensive findings. And I don't think we just... You know, because the testimony at the evidentiary hearing is kind of a wash, I don't think we just throw out the judge's findings and review it de novo and sit in her shoes. I don't think the law supports that. I think there's certain decisions she's entitled to make in the first instance.
Well, counsel observed that had the DNA ruling been correct, he acknowledges that probably the guilt verdict would have been the same. Would you comment briefly on the law on the admissibility of the DNA as well as the facts surrounding the search?
Well, I think guilt was a foregone conclusion, as it often is in these death penalty cases, and the defense is well served to reserve most of their argument for mitigation and penalty rather than arguing so strenuously in guilt and then lose credibility with the jury that they've now got to persuade that even though you found him guilty, we think there's mitigation there. I don't see any basis here to suppress the DNA evidence. If anything, it goes to the weight. They were able to cross-examine our DNA expert. I think there was some inconsistency or some little error in one of his reports that they were able to point out and cross-examine about. And I don't see that goes to the admissibility of the DNA, that would be kept out. Judge Delaney below found that even if they had been able to exclude the DNA, it doesn't change the fact that he had blood all over his clothes. This man with blood phobia stood there and gave a statement to police and pretended to call 911 and find crime. He had blood on him. And he wasn't freaking out at that point. The video, yes, it was grainy, but one of the officers who had interviewed Archanian as a witness, when he then later looks at the video, he says, I just talked to that guy. He was standing out front as one of the reporting witnesses. He had no problem identifying him off of the video, which I don't believe is part of the record. If it was, I'm mistaken, but I don't think it's part of the record in front of this court. But the jurors had an opportunity to view that videotape, and the judge found that the DNA would not have made a difference in this case, even if it had been excluded. The video alone was sufficient to show guilt. So I think the case for guilt is overwhelming.
But my question was intended to be more particularized. Maybe it wasn't. It was the retrieval of the clothing during the course of
the search. On the search warrant, There was a suppression issue of the defendant's statement that this court reviewed on direct appeal and found that to have not been any kind of constitutional violation. I think this court would have found the same if they had raised the Fourth Amendment issue, either below or on appeal. With all the overwhelming evidence and the videotape, the argument that I just made, even without the trace evidence of the DNA itself, they still would have found him guilty. In our brief, this must have been a telephonic warrant because I quoted where the judge had said, you may go do this microscopic crime scene investigation and review or collect DNA samples. And my understanding, they're not challenging the search of the car. And I believe there was some DNA evidence found there, so it wouldn't even have lost all of the DNA evidence.
Mr. Holmes, can I just ask you some questions about this mitigation testimony that was offered post-conviction?
Yes.
About the history of the Armenian. I know, in my knowledge of history, that the Armenians were massacred by the Turks, similar to how Jewish citizens were by the Germans in World War II. This is in World War I. And they were literally wiped out, you know, during World War 1915 when that started. My concern was the timing. You know, the World War I ended in 1918. Armenia became part of the Soviet Union after that, and was until the Soviet Union broke up in 1991. So the timeline kind of bothers me, how much time elapsed between this history and the repatriation of the Armenians and all that. How was that testimony presented, and what context did it tie into Mr. Arkanian's behavior, you know, on?
Well, I don't think it ties in at all. It was presented at the trial and presented anew in habeas that he was a third generation Armenian genocide survivor. I don't even know what that means. And with all due respect to those who suffered as a direct consequence of the genocide, I think when we start talking third generation, I think we're just too far attenuated for that to have much mitigation value without having some other actual connection that he actually experienced something. And there's nothing about that other than that. And the abstract is, I don't know what it is, great-grandfather survived that genocide. Well, what does that mean for Arkanian? There's no testimony here of how that directly impacted him or shaped him.
Well, apparently the argument has something to do with mental health issues and how people are reluctant to delve into them, you know, that they're through the Armenian culture of the people who repatriated to Armenia, whatever. I was having trouble following it on the timeline, so I just wondered if you...
Well, I have trouble following it too, because I don't see any significant mental illness here, and there's a lot of assumptions that he must have inhaled these chemicals and he must have had this, and because he's they have this genocide in the family history, it must have shaped him in some way, and there's no connection tying that to him, showing how in fact he was affected by any chemicals. We have a lot of witnesses on both sides, the victim's family and the defendant's family, who were jewelers, and they all were exposed to these chemicals at different times. And if they had gone with that defense, we could have easily asked cross-examine those witnesses about their experiences with the chemicals, and they turned out just fine. And then, of course, we've got others in Armenian's family, in Armenian's family, who suffered the same sort of childhood oppression from communism, counseling, and the genocide in the family history, and they turned out to be productive members. If it is mitigating, I just think that it's pretty weak, and I don't see that connection directly to Arkanian to explain his behaviors, and what behaviors they do find here are just not that mitigating in terms of justifying his actions here. In fact, in Schottfeld's report, they had to go to England to get a psychologist here. It's Peter Schottfeld. In his report, he says the defendant's finally, this is like 8 years after the murder, he was in denial for a long time, but to Schottfeld, he said that I was angry. And the women, the victims who had taken him in and given him a job in their store, that they hadn't paid him in 2 weeks, and that they had lied to him about how well the business was doing, and he had nothing to show for all his hard work, and so he killed them. I would love to have that. I'd love to have Peter Schottfeld on the stand in a new penalty hearing and elicit the defendant's admissions that this was caused by anger, not due to some blood phobia. There was no blood until he bludgeoned these women with a hammer and a ring sizer through the back of the head.
Mr. Owens, as to a new hearing, you bring it up. Justice Hardesty asked Counsel Mr. Erickson a number of questions about the reweighing and a possible new hearing. What is your position to the response that was given by Mr. Erickson to Justice Hardesty's questions about reweighing and possible new hearing?
Well, I don't think reweighing is before this court on the merits. This court did reweigh and has reweighed in a number of cases. There was a petition for rehearing on direct appeal that challenged this court's reweighing. The federal public defender got involved on the petition for writ of certiorari taken from this court's direct appeal, precisely on the issue of appellate reweighing. And cert was denied, and it's always been denied. And to date, there's no law that I'm aware of that says that we have abandoned as a country appellate reweighing, which is really just a harmless error analysis. The U.S. Supreme Court says there's no difference whether you call it reweighing, which makes it sound like a jury finding. It's really appellate harmless error analysis. It's no different. The U.S. Supreme Court continues to do it to this day. They sought remand and were denied based on a new Hearst case out of Florida, and you're going to see a lot of death penalty cases, habeas petitions with that one issue on whether Hearst somehow changes the spectrum here on appellate reweighing. It's not really briefed here in this case, but that'll be an issue that you'll be dealing with in those other cases on all these Hearst petitions.
At this stage in the proceeding, and I'm not sure I got this from the briefs, but if the issue of the proposed new mitigation evidence is really only relevant to the Strickland prejudice issue, right? Rather
yes.
than to a fresh consideration by us as under the guise of reweighing or any other
yes.
review. So once we've done the reweighing when we struck the invalid aggravator, that's a fait accompli. So it's before us now to assess whether the proffered mitigation establishes prejudice attributable to, let's say, the abject lack of diligent investigation by trial counsel. Let's say he satisfied the first prong of inadequate investigation, and I know your point is the record decipher and the judge found in your favor, but let's set that aside. The mitigation goes to prejudice under Strickland, right? Or is there a larger obligation on us at this point?
Well, I think maybe give the defense more credit. I think they intended appellate reweighing when it was raised below. It was raised and that's why I said it's not before you on the merits. They raised it as a substantive claim and asked the district court judge to sit in judgment of this court's appellate reweighing. And our stock response, and that's raised in a lot of briefs, our stock response is there's no jurisdiction. That's the issue that's in front of this court, is did the district court judge have authority to revisit appellate reweighing and sit in judgment of the Supreme Court?
I'm asking a different question, though, which is, we have, on a direct appeal, we have to evaluate the sentence that was imposed in a death penalty case. When it's at the stage of an appeal from the post-conviction, and we already reweighed in connection with the first go-round, do we have an obligation to go again through that process?
I would say absolutely not. Reweighing, that's law of the case. That's a decision from 10 years ago. Now it's Strickland. Was counsel ineffective in failing to investigate, present this mitigation evidence? And if they had, would it have made a difference in the outcome of the trial? I don't think that you go back.
The evidence of adequate investigation on the penalty phase is troubling. I mean, I think he has a point that there's not substantial evidence to support adequate investigation.
Well, and I would turn it the other way and say there's no evidence that there was no substantial investigation. He may have had 10 experts lined up for all that we know. It's simply not in the record. And to switch that around and say now I must somehow defend a deceased attorney and show that he was prepared and he had done all this work, memories have faded, and even if he was available, Polsky had very
little. My point is, even crediting his position on lack of adequate investigation, you still argue there's an insufficient showing that this defendant was prejudiced by that lack because we don't have concrete mitigation evidence that ties to him and what he did.
Yeah, what they presented here, it shouldn't just be a game of can we go out and find something new that wasn't presented to the jury. I mean, people live long lives, and there's all sorts of aspects of an individual's personality, and you can emphasize or de-emphasize different parts of it. But a kitchen sink approach, where you're going to, it's got 30 family members. I've never seen a death penalty case where they put on 30 family members. The entire trial was just 15 witnesses, I believe. So they're not going to get on 30 witnesses and talk about every single aspect of this person's life. You got to have a theory. You got to have a plan. And here, even though Liam Grayson's deceased, we can see that his theory that he wanted to present to the jury was that there was redeeming qualities of this defendant to save him from the death penalty. Whereas what Mr. Erickson has brought forward is troubling facts that don't endear a jury to the defendant, that don't make the jury like him and say, well, maybe we should save him from death. If anything, it makes him raise an eyebrow and say, well, he's a little odd, he's a little weird, but to mitigate and as a reason to not impose death? Two different strategies, and there's countless ways the Supreme Court says that we can defend these capital defendants.
What were the mitigators that the jury was asked to find, but it did not?
I don't think I have them written down in my notes in front of me, but from memory, it was that he had been fled communist oppression from Armenia, that he had been a father figure, all the things that I said, that he had helped the neighbors, that he had brought other immigrants here to America. Those sorts of things were all, you know, the
what gives the judge a right to deny that, though? I've seen the murder cases I've seen lately with death penalty cases. They have 15 or 16 mitigations because it says, the statute says all other mitigation. Why would that, it was Judge Mosley, wasn't it, who did the trial? Did the original trial?
That may be right. I don't think the judge denied that. The jury received those mitigators.
Oh, they did receive it.
They did receive it.
It's unclear to me that they didn't. That the only mitigation they, so the only mitigation they found was lack of criminal history, but there were other mitigation offered to the jury.
I believe in the instruction they were on that. Any other mitigating circumstances, I believe the defense had spelled out.
They did spell them out, though.
Yeah. You know, it's a big record, and so you may want to double-check, but that's my recollection as I stand here.
Mr. Owens?
Yes.
I'm sorry, we just got this chair. As you know, we deferred ruling on the motion to remand on the Hearst matter, and part of the reason I asked the question about re-weighing, I should have probably been more direct. I didn't hear from Mr. Erickson. I wanted to hear from you about that particular question that's still pending in this record and whether this court should address Hearst in this case now or whether we should have that matter raised by a separate post-conviction by Mr. Arkanian at some future date if he doesn't otherwise prevail here.
Well, thanks for bringing that up. I guess I had remembered that there had been a motion for remand. I assumed it had been denied. I guess I forgot that
it was deferred.
Deferred, okay.
My reading of the record is deferred by us, yes.
Yeah. Well, you're going to be facing it in some case and in a lot of cases. And whether you want to remand this for a decision on that, you know, I don't know. That remand is really necessary. They've clearly raised the issue, and it's simply a new legal case now that they say supports their position. And I've said in my briefing in other cases that it does not stand for that proposition. So I don't know that remand would be necessary. You're going to, you know, the issue was in fact preserved and raised. It was ruled on below, and now they just have new authority. That they want to rely on. I don't think I'd have an objection to this court without remand entertaining that issue and considering the first case which is out there.
Yeah. It seemed like the issue, I was going to ask Mr. Erickson when he comes back up, I meant to do it before, what would be, is this squared up? Can this court reach that issue now? And you seem to think that we could.
Yeah, because they're not raising a new issue. It's not going to be in violation of any procedural bar, and it's purely a question of law, what Hearst means and what it doesn't mean.
Right.
So I don't see a procedural bar as being a problem, and I think it was preserved in there.
So at least from the state's perspective, nothing more would need to be developed in the record in order to reach that legal question?
Correct.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Owens.
Let me see if I touched on all the issues that were raised. looked at all my little check marks. I've discussed everything that I felt was necessary, everything I heard the court ask questions about. I'll submit it to your honors then, unless there's anything further.
I just have one question. Chief, if you or counsel could provide us with the record site, it would help to the instruction on mitigators during the trial.
Well, now I hope I'm right.
Well,
we will look.
It would be helpful to get your assistance, and we'll look too.
Thank you.
Mr. Erickson?
Thank you. To begin with, I want to address the issue of the evidence related to the lack of investigation. It's difficult to prove a negative, but one of the things that we presented were the jail visitation logs of Mr. Archie, and there, in those logs, there is no indication of any expert, any mental health worker, any investigator visiting Mr. Archie while he was in custody there. It was replete with visitations of family and, like I said, four visitations from the lead attorney on the case prior to the trial.
How hard did you press Mr. Amposti on this issue? I mean, I tried the case with him, and he certainly knew everything that we were doing as far as mitigation and guilt or innocence when we had a murder case where the fellow got the death penalty, but luckily it was set aside by the federal court.
Your Honor, at the evidentiary hearing, Mr. Yampolsky testified that Mr. Grayson was solely responsible for the mitigation workup, and he had no information about what was done or was not done.
Did you believe him? I don't.
Well, I certainly didn't have a reason not to believe him. A lot of times, attorneys will break it up so that, as Mr. Owens indicated, there is credibility for the attorney who is focusing on mitigation. One attorney is focusing on the guilt-innocence phase, so and that could have been their strategy. And as you're asking that question, I got a hold of Mr. Grayson before he passed away, and what he told me was he had sent his entire file to Mr. Yampolsky. He had no records. And so then that's when we got hold of Mr. Yampolsky, and he said he didn't receive a file from the individual, but he had no information related to what mitigation had been done. The evidence that we have presented related affidavits from family members of the nearly non-existent communication between Mr. Grayson and the family members, other than right before they were put on the stand, related to some mitigation issues, certainly would indicate that there weren't interviews by experts, things of that nature, prior to this trial. Another thing that was presented from an affidavit was that after Mr. Archinian was found guilty and sentenced to death, that Mr. Grayson contacted the family, told them he would charge them $100,000 to do the appeal, and that he would hire experts for the appeal. And the affidavits indicate that Mr. Yampolsky told the family it's too late to get experts at this point.
Was Grayson a criminal defense attorney?
You're right. Apparently he was. I went on his website early on, and yeah, from what I could tell,
had he tried any death penalty cases before?
Your Honor, from what I saw from his website, he indicated that he had tried death penalty cases and he had never lost one on the website, which I chuckled to myself because I knew I was defending an individual with two death sentences, which was certainly contrary to the website information that he had never lost a death case. But that's the only information that I know.
Dr. Sheffield, there were a lot of things that he found, but yet he was unable to make specific clinical diagnosis because he didn't have enough information. How does that help you when he did all this and he really is not able to opine how that really affected Mr. Arcanian specifically?
And, Your Honor, I would direct you to his final conclusions begin on page 25 of his 30-page report, and he does find various, what he calls, disorders, and they were referred to...
I understand the disorders, but as I said, he didn't make any clinical as to specifically the defendant, Mr. Shapiro.
Well, on page 25, at paragraph 104, it says clinical opinions and diagnoses, and then he indicates diagnosis of mental disorder involving patterns of signs and symptoms into recognizable categories of mental disorder. It is my opinion that Mr. Archanian currently suffers from the following formal mental disorders. And then he goes through the blood phobia, the disassociative features, and he talks about examples of that. And then on page 27, he talks about personality disorder and him coming to a conclusion that he suffers from a personality disorder. And on paragraph 116, he talks about, in particular, avoidant and dependent personality disorders often appear anxious and fearful. And then he talks about disassociative phenomena, parapsychotic features, and self-harm. And then the last one that I think is significant is paragraph 120 on page 28. He talks about anxiety disorder and a mood disorder. So I do believe that from the multiple interviews that he conducted with family members and the 2 days of interviewing Mr. Archanian, that he did find disorders that should have been...
Mr. Erickson, you are out of time, but take 2 minutes and summarize why you think...
I apologize, Chief. I just was going to ask him if he could comment on the Hearst versus Florida issue. We had deferred ruling on the motion on remand. I didn't see where you argued why we would remand that. Why shouldn't we reach that issue in resolving this dispute?
And, Your Honor, that was not something that I prepared for today. I know that that was presented early on, and then the judge had denied it. But part of the issue is that this case was somewhat bifurcated, and Judge Delaney, that issue was before her, and she had denied it. I know that. So the short answer is, I know the argument is that the way the jury instructions were formulated, that it did not require a finding beyond the reasonable doubt by the jury that the mitigating factors outweighed the aggravating factors. And that's the argument from the Hearst decisions, that is something that should be required. We've recently argued that on other capital cases, trying to have courts require that. And so I think that is a short answer, that to find somebody to impose a death sentence, that a jury should be required to find beyond a reasonable doubt that the mitigators, or that the aggravators outweigh the mitigators.
So there really isn't any reason to remand the, is there? The record is sufficient to address that issue.
Yes, Your Honor, as far as the jury instructions that they were presented in the briefing. So okay. That they are there for the
sorry, Chief. I just wanted to cover that issue.
Mr. Erickson, time being at a premium at this point, just final summation as to why we should accept your argument on behalf of Mr. Archanian.
Thank you, Your Honor. This comes down to a death sentence, two of them, being imposed upon an individual with almost no investigation having been done related to mitigation. I respectfully disagree with the state's position as to whether or not a jury would or could consider a number of these things that were found and presented as mitigators that would likely result in a sentence less than death. I think it is critical for this court to make sure that counsel, wherever they come from, that they are following the guidelines of Rule 250 and doing proper mitigation. There is, in this case, a massive amount of information that could have been presented and should have been presented. This was not a mitigation case of putting on seven witnesses in a few hours and hoping the jury did not impose a death sentence. This should have been a week-long presentation from experts, and I do believe that this verdict is not reliable under all the standards articulated by this court and the U.S. Supreme Court, and Mr. Archanian is entitled to a new trial as to the mitigation issue. Thank you very much for your time.
Mr. Erickson, Mr. Owens, thank you for the arguments. Present this day, and should invite, and as was requested, if you could make a submission as to the mitigation instruction and submission by the close of this week. We look at your standing recess till 11:30. This matter stands.